I have a most interesting subject to discuss with you this morning. This is in the ministry of our Lord and Savior. When we were children in Sabbath school.
Hi, everybody. Welcome to the Fundamentalists podcast. My name is Elliot Morgan. I do comedy, or some people think I do, and I also happen to have an interest in philosophy and the world and how to live life. And I happen to share a home with a philosopher named Dr. Peter Rollins, who is actually currently on a different continent right now. So if this podcast sounds a little bit different, or if there's any kind of glitches or anything like that, it's because we're on opposite sides of the globe, which is, of course, a fallacy. Obviously, we live on a flat Earth. And so the subject that we're going into today is sublimation. So if you guys listened to last week's episode, which was how to turn your pain into a stomach ulcer, what we're talking about, and then we talked about kind of the worst ways of handling anxieties. So on this particular episode, we're talking about one of the better ways, and we're going to talk a little bit about art, we're going to talk a little bit about filmmaking, we're going to talk about how all of that stuff pertains to the inner workings of our lives. And so Pete, before we dive in, how are you doing?
I'm doing great. I'm back in Northern Ireland after a four-day film shoot, and that was very exciting.
How's it going so far? Is it everything that you expected it to be?
Oh, it's been incredible. The director, Helen, is absolutely amazing. And the assistant director, Maureen, was incredible. We had an amazing time. The main actor is a guy called David Dalsmalchian and Frederick Bell. And they were just searingly good, beautiful. So the movie is shot
searingly good.
And we are going to be editing next week, and hopefully we'll have at least a rough cut by the start of April, and hopefully we'll have the final cut by the end of April.
That's amazing. And what's the plan after that when the final cut's done?
So we'll be sharing it with some of the people who supported the movie. We'll be putting it into kind of major film festivals. And then I'm also going to find a way to show it in various theaters across the US, and then probably release it online.
So, that's amazing.
I know, it's incredible. And it looks like we're going to be making a feature film out of it, because this is a 20-minute short. But I'm
unbelievable.
Going to start raising money for the big one.
That's amazing. Well, congratulations! I'm so excited.
Oh, I can't believe I'm doing this. It's so fun. We were watching the cuts today, and it looks like a cross between Only God Forgives and Only Lovers Left Alive, which are two movies
Great.
That I absolutely adored I think last year and the year before last.
Are you going to put only in the title now? Is it going to be called Only Making Love so that it further matches those films?
Yeah, the Holy Trinity. Good. Yeah, yeah.
We'll yeah, exactly. Make a bit of
Making Love.
Yeah, exactly. Just making love. So what are we, let's talk a little bit about what we're talking about today.
Yeah, well, ironically, we were going to be doing sublimation anyway, and then I've been on a movie set all week thinking about art. So it feels like we can join these two together.
Love it.
Basically, yeah, Freud talked about how there's many terrible ways to avoid your suffering. But he talked about one of the good ways to do it, and he called that sublimation, which is where you take the difficulties and the sufferings that have happened to you and the difficulty and the trauma of life, and you create something beautiful with it. You make it the fuel to create. It might be beautiful art. It might be becoming a writer. It might be becoming a great cook, raising kids. It might be in terms of fashion, just whatever way it pans out, you take the suffering and you make something wonderful out of the mess. And that's kind of what sublimation is. And so one example of that, of course, is filmmaking. It's an art form where you write a script and you work with people to hopefully create something that that is enjoyable, entertaining, and maybe even revealing of life and what life is about. And I think a good way into this, so I'll say a few words about this and then we'll have a discussion, but a good way into sublimation is to look at the difference between popular movies, like Hollywood movies, and indie movies. I was talking to Helen, the director, about this yesterday, and we were talking about how the main difference is that popular Hollywood movies are generally about idealization, and indie movies tend towards sublimation. And so what that means is Hollywood movies tend towards giving you a fantasy and a painkiller. So a Hollywood movie will give you kind of a morally unambiguous universe, goodies and baddies, right and wrong. You're able to identify who the good person is and the bad person is. They also give you struggle, but a way to overcome struggle and be happy. Maybe it's a romantic comedy and the couple fall in love at the end and get married, or someone, you know, kills the person who killed their family and gets revenge, or the poor person becomes wealthy, whatever it is.
Yeah.
There's something, and then it ends when everything's, you know, happily ever after. It never ends, you know, 6 months later after the kiss, you know, whenever the two people are right. arguing about who to take out the rubbish or whatever. So that is the fantasy. We did an episode on that where basically fantasy is what we use to cover over the ambiguities of life, what we use to cover over the difficulties and the unknowing. We have a fantasy that kind of tells us that we can be happy, whole and complete, and that we can avoid a confrontation with the absurdity of existence. But then you contrast that with indie films. And indie films tend towards what's called traversing the fantasy or breaking the fantasy and confronting you with your suffering in a way that makes it bearable. So a good indie film doesn't give you a fantasy of a, you know, unambiguous moral universe, a very simple way to be happy. It generally shows a morally ambiguous universe. It shows how the good and the bad are intertwined, the beautiful and the ugly are intertwined, joy and suffering are intertwined, and that we, in a sense, have to learn to live with that. But a good indie movie also helps you somehow find beauty in that mix and find a way to celebrate life and say amen to life in the midst of all of that messiness. So there's a few thoughts on idealization and sublimation.
I love it. It reminded me a little bit of this is a deep cut for the fundamentalists, but in Capitalism and Desire, he talks about the moment in some movies, and the one I remember specifically is when he was talking about Drive, and that moment in the elevator when Ryan Gosling just beats the guy to like a bloody pulp, and it's this like show of excess that like is completely unwarranted, and then the elevator door closes and you're left with like him basically, and all of a sudden what he did with that is or what they did in that movie or with those moments is they like reframe your entire understanding of the movie, because the entire time you're like, oh, I'm with this like really cool protagonist, whatever, and then all of a sudden you're whatever. So I don't know if that would like falls into it, but it reminded me a little bit of like how certain truths end up being shown. I don't know if it's at all related to that, but
it is absolutely like one of the beautiful things about Drive, and this is where like some movies are able to do both, is they play with the fantasy and then they expose it. One of my favorite scenes is actually from Austin Powers. I don't know which one it is, but there's a moment where the baddies all kind of get their money, like $100 million or something.
Yeah, so like I think it's like, is it $1 million? I haven't seen it since.
But they all start laughing, you know, like the maniacal laughter of we finally got the thing that makes us happy. But at any regular movie, then there'd be a cutscene to something else, but the camera stays on them, and then, you know, the laughing becomes a bit embarrassed, and then they start to, you know, cough, and then it goes kind of quiet, and then they all just look at each other. And it's a beautiful expression of how the fantasy of Hollywood is they get the money and they're so happy, but actually, you know, the exposing of the fantasy is seeing what happens 5 minutes later, you know?
Love it. That's so fun. Yeah.
That's what we're trying to do with Making Love, interestingly, is the first three quarters of the movie is the fantasy. It's like this film noir. We've got a femme fatale. And a femme fatale, basically, and most people know this, but it's a woman a woman who you will die for, a woman who will cause you to kill yourself. It's a form of what's called a mort courtois, where you, a woman who is someone who you will just like cut your throat for.
And what's so the term? What was it?
Femme fatale.
Femme fatale. Yeah.
So the woman who you will die for. And so it's a typical femme fatale fantasy with the noir elements. But then the last quarter is where that is exposed. And this is how I think you can actually make a commercial movie that is also an indie. It plays with our fantasies and ultimately exposes them.
Yeah, I never really thought of the distinction between indie and mainstream movies being anything other than like budget and cast. So this is like, even thinking about the two like types of movies as genres is totally new to me.
Yeah. It was funny, like, talking to Helen about it and just, you know, really clarify the difference. And I think a beautiful way to think about it is the difference between idolizing someone and sublimating someone. So if you have a boyfriend or girlfriend and you idolize them, what you do is you think they're perfect, that they're complete, they're amazing, they could not do anything wrong. You know, you put them on a pedestal. But the problem with that is eventually, they'll do something that's not good, and then your illusion is broken and you might break up with them and then go out with someone else. So for example, in LA you see people perpetually going on dates, honeymoons, like honeymoon periods, and then breaking up with someone as soon as the idolized other does something that breaks the illusion, breaks the fantasy. So people can't have long-term relationships. But the opposite is not to go.
That's so sad. Yeah. I got real sad there for a second. So
I know, I see it all the time. It's very difficult. Obsessives are really bad at that. Obsessives often can only fall for people who they're not close to. As soon as they become close to the other and see the other's subjectivity, they lose all their passion for them. So it's very painful. People think obsessive, that, oh, they're out there, he's just sleeping around, he's having such a good time, he doesn't care. But often that's the most depressing type of life. That type of guy is like deeply depressed, because as soon as he gets to know someone, he no longer desires them. That's very depressing.
It's like it's the scene in Austin Powers over and over and over again, just with sex instead of $1 million.
Like, oh, exactly. You have this brilliant moment and then it just all fades away. but then the opposite isn't just to see everybody as normal. If you have a couple and they say, my child is the most beautiful child in the world, and you go, well, hold on, they're not the most beautiful child in the world. I mean, of course they're not. How could you have a child who is objectively the most beautiful child in the world? That's ridiculous, right? It's got big ears and wonky nose. You're misunderstanding what the parents are saying. Just when someone says, my religion's the best religion in the world, sometimes they actually mean it, but often they are just saying that from their subjective experience. So whenever someone says, my child's the most beautiful child in the world, it's stupid to say, no, it's not. Because what they're saying is, my child is become...
I hope you learned. Did you learn this firsthand?
Yeah, well, there's a beautiful scene from my favorite comedians, Mitchell and Webb, where there's a wedding, and the best man gets up just after the groom has said to the most beautiful woman in the world. And the best man says, well, like, no, she's not. And then all the people in the room go, oh, you can't say that. And he says, hold on. Do you people literally think she's the most beautiful woman in the world? Like, if she was the most beautiful woman in the world, the paparazzi would be here. We'd be drinking champagne and not Prosecco. And it goes on and on like this. But the idea is he's completely misunderstanding what's being said. So the alternative to idealization is not to say, oh, my child is just average looking, right? That's just as ridiculous. But the opposite is sublimation.
Kind of a psychotic parent is like, oh, my kid, yeah, they're like every, like, what's your kid like? Yeah, they're pretty much like every other kid.
Yeah.
Like, I feel like that would be the most, like, I would not trust that human being if they said something like that.
I saw a cartoon once where there was this company making mugs saying "World's Greatest Dad," and after the first one came out, the foreman shut the machine down and said to the manager, "Listen, it would be logically incoherent to make more than one of these cups, right? Because there could only be one World's Greatest Dad." But then the alternative, of course, isn't a mug that says "You're the most average dad. You know, you're all right, good at some things, and crap at other things."
You're a dad.
You're a dad. You know, you're pretty much in the like maybe top 50 percentile. Like maybe. But which would be obviously be a good mug, but sublimation is where you basically, it's like idealization. You go, no, my child is the most beautiful child in the world. But you're
so
saying,
So I know all sublimation is not art or filmmaking, to be more specific, but do you consider all filmmaking to be a form of sublimation, like cinema itself to be sublimation, or is it typically only indie films that are because they express that truth in a certain way?
Well, in terms of filmmaking, I think, like, broadly speaking, you could stick them into idealization or sublimation, which is either, you know, the movie is a fantasy that's kind of giving you a type of perfection and wholeness and, you know, a hero that where everything works out and the bad person is vanquished in a morally unambiguous universe, or sublimation, which is you get a universe that is messy and dirty and broken, but beautiful. That somehow
it reminds,
when you watch a good movie, it kind of draws you into the depth of life in all its messiness.
Yeah. It reminds me a little bit of, in high school, the brief, like, knowledge or experience I had with Shakespeare, the different, like, as I recall, and I could be totally wrong about this, but I think like the Shakespeare comedies and Shakespeare tragedies are pretty much only differentiated between happy ending and sad ending. And it sounds like that's similar, where it's like the happy ending is the idealization. And then the sad ending would be the tragedy, would be kind of the ugliness of life in some way.
Yeah, I mean, and your comedy and tragedy, that we should do a whole podcast on that, because there's an interesting distinction there that's really important. I mean, if you could have a movie, but that doesn't sublimate, you could have a movie that just exposes the pain and the suffering and the difficulty of life, but you wouldn't want to watch it.
Yeah.
I think one of the rules of art is to make the difficulty bearable, to make the difficulty beautiful, to mingle joy and suffering in an interesting way. Whereas, you know, and by the way, some Hollywood movies do it beautifully, and Drive is a great example of a movie that I think is commercially successful and also is powerful, you know, in terms of revealing the truth. But often
I love it.
Yeah, often you'll find Hollywood movies, that's why I call them painkillers. They're a great way to escape your suffering for a couple of hours, but they don't help you confront it.
You didn't see Mother, did you?
Oh, I didn't, not yet. No, because I feel that that's going to be a harsh one to watch.
It's
going to be beautiful, but harsh.
Ruin your day. It'll ruin your day. Horrible, horrible film. Really, truly hate it, but also kind of like am fascinated by it, because I thought about it when you said like you can have a film that is not, because I would consider Mother, if you're going to have an indie, I think it would fall into the indie category, but it's so dark that like it's almost like it's not, it felt like abusive to the audience. It felt like the filmmakers were trying to literally kind of emotionally abuse the viewer, and so I feel like something like that would be it's interesting, because it almost sounds like an acting out thing, you know, like a violent, if you're being abusive towards somebody, then that would be like a lesser defense mechanism. But in form of like, in terms of sublimation, that film is basically just like taking all of the anxieties that this filmmaker or writer or whatever was experiencing, and then just like telegramming it to everybody and being like, rather than concealing it through art, because something you were talking about earlier, or we were talking about previously, was unconcealment, and then doing it like the act of kind of like making something, like bearable that was previously hidden. And it seems like in order to do that, the whole idea is that it makes it bearable. And a film like Mother, which is just this like assault on you, doesn't seem like it's making it bearable. It almost just seems like it's trying to do the opposite of that.
Yeah. I mean, that's the horror genre in many ways, a horror genre is to expose the unbearable absurdness of reality without giving too much of the consolations of art. And there's something very cathartic about that. But I do think that good indie movies, they do have to shake us out of complacency. That's why I actually find them really hard to watch. Because with books, I enjoy that. But weirdly, with film, I do want a painkiller. So it's so easy for me to go to, you know, some like pop movie. But whenever I'm going to go and see a Lars von Trier movie or something, or Tarkovsky, I'm like, okay, this is going to expose to me something really difficult about my life. And how do I know they're going to end with something quite beautiful, like a sublimation, some way of like affirming that. I'm like, oh, I'm going to have to go through that difficult emotional journey. And sometimes you just don't want to do it.
I remember when I was in high school, I think I was in high school, and The Passion of the Christ came out.
Oh, yeah.
And I remember, like, before I went in there, it was me and I guess girlfriend at the time. We were very Christian and very in that world. And, you know, everything that was being said about that movie was that it was just this, like, incredibly emotional, very difficult to watch, gut-wrenching depiction of the crucifixion. And so when we went to see it, you know, it's like a packed theater because the thing was just blowing up. And we brought tissues because we were like, we're going to cry at Jesus, you know, for sure. Mm-hmm. And I remember not being moved in like the slightest, but like trying to be and like wanting this movie to like give me that like, you know, really harsh cathartic thing. And maybe it's just the fact that I was so young and I couldn't like appreciate it. And maybe it was the film itself. I don't really remember because I haven't seen it since then. But I just, when you said like the, like going into a theater and having that like anxiety, I remember having that. And then also that anxiety not being delivered, like, like nothing bad happened where I was just like, oh, okay, I guess I should have. And then I felt like a bad Christian for a long time. So, and I'm sure that happens to you.
I guess you were so used to hearing that kind of story. Maybe it was, it wasn't so emotionally wrought because you know.
I think you're right. Yeah. Because like, I remember like when I remember the crucifixion and like being Pentecostal or / Assemblies of God, that like, you know, the pain and the horror of the crucifixion and the, like the goriness of it was something that was talked about in youth group a lot and all that stuff. And so I think I just had a much harsher like idea in my head than what Mel Gibson did.
Yeah, he used I can't remember the mystic, but there was some, I read her once, there was a mystic who really went into depth about the horror of the crucifixion. I think very much influenced him. One of the things I liked about that movie, but is that he resisted the temptation to kind of end it with a real positive kind of like resurrection kind of end, which I thought was kind of interesting. So you know, I've got the critiques of the film, but I did like the way that at the end he didn't tie it in a nice bow. In other words, kind of like you went through the cathartic pain, just like in a Hollywood action movie where you see Arnold Schwarzenegger having to go through all of this horror, and then at the end everything is wonderful and fantastic.
That's
I think it's fantasy for me. The ultimate fantasy is that, you know, it's just like how consumerism works. Is it's difficult. You have to work really hard, but then you'll get the money or the retirement or the home that will make everything great. I think that's a fantasy that has to be broken.
Oof. Yeah, I was having a discussion about that with a friend a couple days ago, and I was like, then we'll be happy. Once this next thing, then we'll be good. And there's always that thing where it's like, especially doing with stuff with the Valley Folk thing, where it's like, okay, we have this, we're doing this, but then once this happens, then we'll be good. And then it's just like, I'm like, oh no, this doesn't end. Yes, we're always going to be waiting for that next thing. Anyway, so what indie films, like, because I don't know a lot about indie films, and so if I don't have a lot to say here, that's why. But like, what can you tell people about indie films who maybe are like me and don't know much about them?
Yeah.
Any like specifics or any kind of like where should I go to even to watch an indie film?
Yeah. Well, I mean, there's the great thing is there is a whole network of cinemas all over the world that kind of show indie movies. But I've got to say, I have to be perfectly honest. I have to be in a good mood to go and see independent movies because they often are a bit of an emotional roller coaster. But like, you know, take the film that we're currently making, you know, one of the ideas behind it is that actually it's in a sense, what's more traumatic to us as human beings than difficulty and suffering and brokenness the idea of embracing a mundane life. So, for example, the femme fatale, someone is more willing to die for a woman, a femme fatale, than they are to go, maybe a woman isn't worth dying for. That's more traumatic. Like, what's more traumatic than dying for somebody, a man or a woman, is the idea that maybe that's a meaningless act, and that there's nothing that makes life completely meaningful. And so
hold on. Are you saying that it's like the idea of the femme fatale is like somebody would rather die for a woman than risk not wanting to?
Yes.
Like, that's even then, oh my gosh, that is good stuff. Oh, that explains everything. Gosh, that's great. That's good. That's great, man. Big fan.
That's the amour courtois thing, which developed in France, which was this idea that a lady, and usually say a king or royalty, would marry, and then a knight would dedicate his life to the lady, and he would sacrifice for her, but he would never consummate the relationship. They would rarely sleep together. They would rarely be together. And at first you look at this love triangle, where this lady is married to a man who she has sex with, and then she has this other man who dedicates his life to her. And you go, well, what is he getting out of it? But one of the things he gets out of it is the fantasy of a perfect relationship, like that she is so incredible and amazing, when actually what's more dangerous than being killed in a battlefield for the lady is a normal relationship. That's what the knight is really afraid of.
That's so good. That reminds me of Game of Thrones. You know, the guy who just follows Daenerys around everywhere and constantly dedicating his life. Yeah,
that's exactly it. I didn't think of that, but that's a form of amour courtois, is that she has a few guys around her. Mm-hmm. She's always the impossible object. And that creates the idea of a fantasy of wholeness and completeness and oneness. So in the movie Making Love, the idea is that there's something much more threatening than someone with a gun who will kill them if they stay together, and it's a normal relationship with all of the rubbish and all of the having to do the dishes and having to argue about the laundry. And
let's talk maybe about that just for a second, because I don't want to go straight too far from kind of the comparisons that we're making. But like the mundaneness, I feel like that is getting crapped on a lot. But I mean, would you argue that also the challenge of entering into a normal, mundane, steady relationship is also rewarding in the long run, because you end up, you know, you take the good with the bad and you have a better understanding of life? Or do you think that we're doomed to always want that femme fatale?
Yeah, well, and I think this is the move from idealization into the mundane, into sublimation. So the first thing happens is when you are actually with the person you idolize, eventually that breaks open and then you realize the mundane nature of it. But if you're able to embrace the mundane, the other side of that is sublimation, which is where in the mundane, everyday stuff, making sandwiches, going to work, watching a movie together, you find a depth and a density to life that is actually more beautiful and rewarding than idealization. It's a mingling of sorrow and joy. It's a mingling of the superficial and the deep in one place.
That I was thinking, I spent, you know, 10 years in a married circumstance, and now I'm not in that anymore. I don't know if you know that or not.
Saying it, a married circumstance.
I was in this whole situation. Let's just say I was married, but I remember that kind of like that certain mundaneness. Like I remember the stability. And I remember the monotony, and I remember like the kind of day in, day out stuff, walking the dog, and like at night and in the morning, then you do the things and you go and you clean, and you know, on Saturdays you do this, and then you go to Home Depot and you fix things. And like, it was so weird, cause I have this like weird suburban, early suburban life when I was very young, and when I look back on that time, the stuff that I do value was those kinds of like little moments of very mundaneness. Like at the time I was like, oh God, if I didn't have this, like, you know, kind of, especially toward the end when I was just more and more unhappy, I was like, what if I just didn't have this, like, you know, thing that was like, you know, I could just break free and da 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 da. And now on the other side of that, it's like, I totally think that that's correct what you're saying, because it's there on the other side of it. It's still the kind of like, oh, I missed that, you know? So it's fun. I get it a little.
Yeah. And that's the thing that I think is one of the challenges of life, is people all around, magazines, movies, TV shows, are always saying that the big win is just over the horizon if you just do something incredible and amazing. And by the way, it's fun to do big things. I think we should challenge ourselves to you know, be better at what we do. But actually, the real challenge is to go that the depth dimension of life is can be found in everything. And actually, sometimes the most extreme stuff is the most boring. You know, it's always the constant pursuit of the big thing that's going to make the person, the perfect person, the perfect job, the perfect this, the perfect that. That just is a way of hiding. You know, we're running so fast towards a goal that we don't have to look at the difficulties of our lives. And actually stopping and looking, you know, can lead to more joy and more happiness.
I was, you know, to segue a little to the art, when art comes into that, when you're sort of like, when you're in that tension, and then, because I love how you put the, you know, you go from idealization to the mundane, and then through the mundane you cope with the mundane through sublimation or whatever, and I think that's like awesome. I love it. It reminded me, you know, the movie that I've cried the most at is the it's an emotional roller
boogaloo.
Well, when Matthew McConaughey's parents leave him in his house, you know, all alone, that's a crazy moment. You remember when you said Matthew McConaughey?
Well, you're a big fan of him drinking whiskey, from what I remember.
Yeah. Oh yeah, that's what it was. It was like ad. We were talking about ads. We're talking about our wine thing. But anyway, yeah. So the movie that basically it's akin to like a Home Alone 2, because I was watching this movie with my friends Joe, Lee, and Steve, and we watched a movie called Coco. And which is a Pixar film, and it's about this, I guess, like, it's about the Dios de la Muerte or whatever, the Day of the Dead. And it's, you know, a beautiful movie. But what struck me about it is when it was done, like, usually if I cry during a movie, I'm like, oh, I cried, what a great movie, that was so cathartic. But that movie, when it was done, like, it was beyond, like, having just experienced it. Like, it wasn't, like, usually if I get emotional about a movie and then I cry or whatever, or I tear up, by the time the credits roll, I'm like, okay, I'm good. That movie left me completely open. Like, as the credits were rolling, I had to, like, take a moment because I was about to just burst out crying. It's so good. I love it so much.
I've never seen this. So, like, what was it about the movie that's so moving?
I think you'd really enjoy it. I don't know what it was that struck me so deeply with it, but basically it's like this boy, he's a musician, and he's a brilliant musician, and he's obsessed with music, but his family hates music because, his great-great-granddad left their family, to pursue his dreams. And so there's a lot of themes in it, I think, that you'd really connect with. And then, but by the end of it, basically what happens is during the, and I'm not going to spoil anything, but the Day of the Dead happens, and then he ends up in kind of the other side where you, like, pass through after death. And the way they depict the afterlife is amazing. The way they depict, you know, like, it's like essentially, it's just so cool. Like, you should definitely watch it. When you're back, if we'll rent it or something. But it was, we'll have a Coco night. And but yeah, it was like when I was done, I had never felt that level of, like, from viewing what I would consider a piece of art and then just having that moment afterward that was like, it was still affecting me. And I felt like full after it was done. I felt like a better, like, person, as something had just been, like, fixed. But in those brief moments afterward, I was just gone. So, yeah.
And anyway, it's a kids' movie, is that right? Because I was, Yeah. Because I was going to say, yeah, because like kids' movies are often brilliant at this. I've seen a couple. I never saw all of Inside Out, I have to confess. But from what I've heard about it, it kind of does what we're talking about as well. It's a kids' movie that basically says, well, you want happiness and you want everything to be great, but actually you need to make space for sadness as well. And I'm going like, wow, that in its own way, that's a way of breaking the fantasy and mingling joy and sorrow in a beautiful children's movie.
Yep. Yeah. That's a great example. Toy Story 3. Has that similar thing that when the characters are kind of like falling into the fire, basically, and you're like, they're going to melt these toys. That did the same thing. Like Pixar has their pulse on how to like connect these like really deep truths. But I know that's adjacent to the indie versus mainstream stuff, but the effect of the art still resonated with me.
Yeah. I mean, the problem with Batman, I'm a big fan of Batman, but is the problem with Batman as a person, not the movies, is he just hasn't dealt with the death of his parents. He has avoided mourning, so he's in melancholy, which is basically where you avoid mourning, and he then dresses up in rubber and beats up criminals, and it's a really impotent gesture. I mean, he doesn't really want to fix Gotham because that's not really going to work. Beating up a few criminals in a massive city is not going to do you any good. Basically, buying tanks is ridiculous. Buying $1 million tanks to drive around Gotham is not as effective as doing an after-schools program or setting up a job training program with Wayne Industries. So he's absolutely wasting his money in a weird attempt to fix Gotham. But actually all it is a impotent outburst of his inability to actually deal with the death of his parents. And so
isn't that what makes him interesting though? Like the reason I don't like Superman is because he's so perfect.
Yes, I mean, Batman would be really boring if the next film was about him setting up an after-schools program in Gotham City with his money. And that would definitely not be as interesting. But here's the thing, like, the Joker cannot do all of that mayhem without loads of people working for him. And those people work for the Joker. Some of them might be psychos, but most of them are just people who can't get a job. They don't have healthcare. They don't have dental. They've got kids to look after. You know, so if you could give those people jobs, the Joker would have nobody working for him.
Yeah,
he'd be easy to catch. You know,
and so, you know they're not. They're providing for their family. They're putting, you know, they're sheltering their children so that their children can have safe upbringings and will probably contribute to society more than Batman did.
And do you think they want to work for the Joker? I mean, the Joker is crazy. You don't want to work for a guy like that. He'd kill you if you do something wrong, or Bane or whatever. These people are not nice people to work for. They're bad. They're bad job conditions. They are dangerous. But that's the only thing going in Gotham City. And then you have Wayne Industries. On Friday night, he beats up criminals, right? Beats up these guys. And then on Monday morning, he goes into Wayne Industries and makes billions of dollars. And then what does he do? He spends loads of that on stupid high-tech equipment, as if that's going to really make an impact.
It's not stupid high-tech equipment. It's pretty cool high-tech equipment.
Well,
so
it is pretty good high-tech equipment.
Let's draw the line where I don't want to... I love Batman very much, but that is so fun, dude. It's so fun. Where it's like, yeah, Monday through Friday, he creates conditions that impoverish the community around him, that creates criminals, and then he turns around, beats up four criminals, and then calls himself a superhero.
Yeah, it's almost like imagine a society where we create the conditions for homelessness, and then on a Friday night, we give them food in a soup kitchen and think we're doing good.
I can't imagine.
It's hard to imagine a society like that.
Yeah. Ugh. It sounds so illogical. Logical, but yes. You know. I was having a conversation with somebody recently about like some kind of like like the act of caring about the poor and how like I like voting for ways that take care of the poor. Like one of the reasons I think I swung left politically was because I knew that that I wasn't going to a soup kitchen and I wasn't like volunteering in any way, but I knew that I could probably start directing my vote toward toward the impoverished, but I had to first reach that conclusion of like, oh man, like I do care, but at the same time, I really like, you wouldn't know it by my actions ever. Like I've never, like a part of me wants to do that and has thought about doing it and just like making it a regular thing. But that, you know, even then I feel like I would be doing it because I would want to like experience it and that kind of thing. So
well, yeah, that's the difficulty is sometimes we can, you know, we can do something on a Friday night that helps us just feel better about what we do Monday to Friday. I mean, that's the Batman situation right there. Now, what I love about Batman, by the way, is that occasionally in the Nolan movies, they do actually touch on this. That's why I think they're good movies. Is I think it's in the last one where Batman basically goes, I'm part of the problem. I mean, that was part of the storyline. It's like, oh my goodness, these supervillains exist because of me, and I am somehow interconnected with them. I mean, that's a big insight. Because this brings me, this is good, the difference between abstract and concrete. So in contemporary society, we think concrete things are what you see, right? You see someone drinking, you see someone committing a crime, and that's concrete. And abstraction is when you kind of talk about the conditions, why they committed the crime, etc. So Judge Dredd is the epitome of a concrete thinker. Judge Dredd comes in, he sees you commit a crime, he judges you and kills you. So that's concrete. But actually in philosophy, it's the other way around. And Zizek talks about this using Hegel, is that in philosophy, the concrete is when you see the crime in relation to the education of the person, the social conditions, the society as a whole. And abstraction means taking the person out of the conditions that they're immersed in. That's actually, so it's the opposite. Abstraction is when, so Judge Dredd is the ultimate abstractor. He abstracts the criminal from their school, from their family conditions, from the apocalyptic war that happened or whatever occurred. So he abstracts the criminal from all of that and judges them just in relation to what he sees at a particular moment in time.
Yeah.
Why was I saying that?
I don't know, but it reminded me of, it was from the Batman thing, how Batman realized that he kind of was creating the thing.
He realized, because Batman was an abstract thinker because he was abstracting the criminals in Gotham from the conditions that created the problem. And what Nolan does is he very subtly starts to help Batman become a concrete thinker, i.e. realize that these are conditions. Like, for example, like Hillary Clinton voters may be beginning to realize that they're not separate from, you know, what's going on with Donald Trump, that maybe the liberal and the conservative somehow interact with each other, right? You know, that's the political connotations of this.
To say, not to harp too much on Batman, but I know he touches on it a little overtly in The Dark Knight Rises, but there's even that hints at it in Batman Begins, in the first one that he did, where at the very end, James Gordon in his monologue is like, we buy semi-automatics, they buy automatics, we buy Kevlar, they buy armor-piercing rounds, but if you extend that line to like, we have Batman, then it's like, we have Batman, they'll have Joker, Bane, Catwoman, da-da-da-da. So it's like,
The themes are there. And then the very last one of the trilogy, it ends where he gives his mansion to an orphanage, or he makes it into an orphanage, which is I think that happens. And if it does, it's a beautiful symbol of going, this mansion used to be where the Batcave was and where all these weapons were. And he thought that that was the way to help Gotham City. But at the very end, he leaves the mansion, he gives it to an orphanage, and it's like, no, that is what is going to change Gotham City.
I thought I just remembered Joseph Gordon-Levitt going down into the Batcave and kind of the Batcave.
He did, but I guess that as well. Oh no, but I think the orphans are upstairs, and then he's hanging out looking at porn downstairs. Or something.
I don't know, real creeper, being a real Joseph Gordon-Levitt down there. Yeah, that's great stuff, man. You said something after that. You kind of extended it out, and I had a thought, but I don't remember what it was. It was something about something after the Batman realizing he created his own stuff.
Yeah, well, there's beautiful. I actually really like those Nolan films because you know, the Joker is saying this. He's got, like, he says, "I'm not trying to kill you," to Batman. He goes, "I don't want you complete me." You know, it's like, I wouldn't exist without you. That's again a beautiful move from thinking the Joker is some insane criminal disconnected from Gotham City to going, "Oh no, the Joker is a creation of Gotham and a creation of the Batman, and we're all interwoven together." A friend of mine directed a movie called The Good Man, a guy called Phil Harrison, and it's a beautiful expression of this, because half of it's set in Belfast, where this banker indirectly is responsible for the death of somebody, and he finds out that person gives money to a child in South Africa, so he starts to sponsor this child. And the other half of the movie is about that child and how he's becoming politicized and asking questions about why the new South Africa doesn't look that different from the old South Africa. But what's beautiful about the movie is the banker, the guy in Belfast, although he's giving money to this kid, he's involved in bank deals that are destructive to the township that this kid lives in. And so what you see by watching the movie is that although these people are separated by thousands of miles, they are interconnected with each other. There's a beautiful quote it opens with of Calvin, where he says, "I think we are all woven together in a single thread," something like that. And the whole movie is showing how actually my life here really does impact the life of people on the other side of the planet.
That's so crazy. Yeah. I know. It's like... I was talking like the idea of just decision making in general and planning things and postponing things. I'm like, it's funny how the little decisions you make end up just like completely having a butterfly effect on those around you and your life as a whole. And nobody thinks about it. We're all just like kind of clogging through.
Yeah.
Our thing.
Yeah. This might be another way. You know, I said at the beginning that, you know, Hollywood movies tend towards idealization, indie movies tend towards sublimation. Another way to cut it, which is very similar, is to say, Hollywood movies tend towards abstraction, i.e. you've got a criminal and, oh, they're baddie and you're the goodie and you kill the baddie, everything's great. And a good indie film tends towards concretization. In other words, showing how situations are more complex and we're interwoven together and political and economic and social issues are at play. Now, of course, doing that in a way that's fun is the trick.
Totally.
That does that. You know, like, of course, Batman setting up a school for underprivileged kids is going to be a rubbish movie. but what Nolan did is, and Nolan, I think he played with those themes, and what he did is he gradually exposed the audience to concretization in a Hollywood movie.
This is why I think we're in the golden age of television right now, because television shows are, I mean, probably not starting, but at its peak, I think would be Breaking Bad and confronting like the economic and real life pressures that like occur, and just showing, you know, the anti-hero story and all that stuff, and all the ways, you know, the different directions that Walter White gets pulled in. It made me think of like Ozark, and how Ozark is similar in that it's this sort of like guy who gets mixed up because of finances, because of you know, wanting more and more money, and he gets looped in, and he you know, it's revealed later on that he knew about it, but he came, you know, this is the situation that he was in. And then, like, you know, the showing the kids and how the kids adapt to a new environment, and like the pressure that puts on him. And it's so you have so much more room in television, especially with like a lot of these Netflix shows and HBO shows, to just like explore those things. Whereas with a film, it's like you have to, especially like a major motion picture, you're going to end up just leaving so much crap out to get out, you know, these like plot points. And like movies to me just aren't where it's at anymore in general. And maybe I am tired of like the idealization that happens in major movies. And maybe that's why, you know, I think about movies like Mother or even Coco more. Mother and Coco are not two movies that should ever be used in the same sentence. But yeah, I think that's why TV is killing it right now. And it takes a lot for me to want to go see a movie these days.
Yeah, no, and I think you get sick of them. The older you get, the more, although we love repetition. I mean, whenever someone masturbates, they fantasize often over pretty much the same thing. And we go back to the same fantasies in Hollywood. But there's also a point where you kind of get bored of that, of returning to the cinema for the same fantasy, the same, the same, it's what's called compulsive repetition, where nothing changes. You just, it's like Laurel and Hardy, you know, there's a problem, they kill it, they sort it out, and then you go back and you revisit it. Whereas a good indie film breaks you out of compulsive repetition. It actually brings you somewhere. That's the difference between a tragedy and a comedy, by the way. Comedies are more tragic because in a comedy, nobody learns. Nothing happens. The characters are comedic because, in a sense, they don't go anywhere. But often in a tragedy, the character might die or something terrible happens, but they also undergo often a change, and they often embrace their suffering and embrace the end.
That's interesting. It's like the sitcom. The formula for the sitcom is very much like Dan Harmon has his story circle that he does where, you know, you go through the eight steps of the character, but the last one is, you know, the hero returns, but slightly changed, but it's only slightly. And in a sitcom, it's like, it's infinitesimal. Like there's nothing to it. And so you loop all the way back around to the situation that you began with, and there's absolutely no growth.
This is the beautiful thing about The Office, by the way. Ricky Gervais created an incredible show, the British one anyway, because it was only, I think, three seasons. And it had the Laurel and Hardy element, obviously a boss who thought he was a Renaissance man, thought everyone loved him, etc. And, of course, the humour is he always does something that's humiliating. And it's a very subtle thing because if he doesn't realize he's humiliated, there's no comedy, right? Because if he just keeps on going, you're waiting for the punchline. The punchline is when he realizes he's an idiot. But if he totally realizes he's an idiot and cries, that's not funny. That's a bit depressing. So you have to have the character, they know they're an idiot, but they refuse to acknowledge their knowledge. So they refuse to know.
There's a scene in The American Office where Michael Scott is he falls into a koi pond, and it's this big embarrassing thing for him, and he starts getting made fun of and by the rest of the employees, and so he's super offended by it, and he's like, how, he's like, these guys, he's like, I don't like when they're making fun of me. He's really sensitive about it, and basically at some point Jim comes up to him and he's like, you know what you gotta do? You gotta join in. You gotta make fun of yourself. You gotta do it with them, you know, because they're only laughing at you because you're not joining in the fun. And so he goes out into the office and he's like, you know what? It is dumb that I, what a klutz I am falling into that koi pond. And you know what? That's the second time I did it. And he keeps going on this monologue and it gets sadder and sadder until he's like, and the kid, you know, and kids used to make fun of me when I was in all the like laughter that starts with the employees all of a sudden just like dies down. And they start to see that he's just like confessing of these like sad things about his life. And, but everyone's just like, ha 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 ha. Like then he never really realizes it's so good. And it's exactly what you're talking about.
That is genius, and that's exactly how The Office ends in the UK, because what happens at the end is that Ricky Gervais, or the character, realizes he's an idiot, and as soon as he realizes he's an idiot, like he really embraces it, two things happen. Firstly, he's no longer an idiot. So the irony is, as soon as you acknowledge that you're an idiot, you stop being the butt of the joke, because like now you're a tragic character, not a comedic character. And so secondly, the comedy's over. And that's what is so beautiful about that series. And also, by the way, the film they made afterwards about him being on tour, I can't remember what it's called, but with his band. But the idea is, you know, it's like, you know, the gargoyles on top of churches that are called grotesques. The grotesques are there because they're laughing at us. They're on top of these buildings, laughing at all of the stupid people going around their day, thinking that they're important and wonderful and amazing. It's like a sitcom and they're the audience. And the only way to get out of the sitcom of life is to acknowledge that you're an idiot, is to acknowledge that you're fragile, that you have anxieties and that you have difficulties. And weirdly, just like in The Office, the UK Office, when he finally embraces that, he becomes a heroic character. He becomes a beautiful character, and he hasn't even changed. It's not that he's become thinner and more attractive and more cool. He's just become a character who you feel has really accomplished something, has actually accomplished the real challenge of life. And so it ends, it finishes.
The movie is David Brent, Life on the Road.
It's brilliant. Oh, so, so good.
Yeah.
And you see exactly, if anyone who's listening to this watches it, just bear in mind this arc, the arc of the constantly humiliated, knows it, but doesn't allow himself to acknowledge the knowledge. And then how he eventually comes to acknowledge it, and how in that acknowledgement he becomes a character that you can admire, respect, and even want to hang out with.
That's great. Do you want to? I was going to offer some final thoughts.
Oh, how are please you feeling do. About that? What's your takeaway from this?
Takeaway. That's what it is. Yeah. Final thoughts. What am I? A moron? my takeaway would basically be that thank God for art. Because holy crap, and what a beautiful thing that we have in filmmaking, and what a beautiful thing we have in like escapism of any kind. Because like, I mean, it's 2018. You are making a film that yourself, just because you have the option to do it in this day and age, and because of whatever. Yeah, and I think it's so incredible that like, and it reminds me of the same thing with the Valley Folk stuff and being able to create comedy again, and like the act of being able to do that and consume it, let alone create it, I think is just like, it's so great. Like it's an amazing thing.
That. We're only able to do that because of the generosity of so many people. I mean,
yeah.
My goodness, like we are
both of us, yeah.
At the behest of wonderful people, we are indebted to the generosity of so many.
Yeah, sorry, which I think, that alone kind of changes so many of my other perspectives, where I'm like, so much of my life is because of the generosity of other human beings. And that's a beautiful thing.
So is that your takeaway?
That's it. Yeah. Thank God for art, or thank God for movies, I guess.
Yeah. Well, my takeaway, I think that idea of the grotesques on the top of churches that are laughing at us, is a good thing to bear in mind, that the world is a sitcom. The grotesques are sitting up there, the audience that are amused at us thinking that we're amazing and incredible. And the only way out of the sitcom is to acknowledge that we have anxieties and sufferings and difficulties. And art helps us do that. Art helps us good art can help us come to see that and embrace that in ourselves, just like a good comedian can help us to laugh at the silly things we do. And weirdly, as we're able to do that, we're able to escape the sitcom of life and become truly heroic characters, finding the depth and beauty of life in the midst of the mundane.
I mean, that's basically what I said, so yeah.
Perfect.
That was fantastic. That was the prime example of me saying, oh man, thank God for movies, and then you swoop it in with the gargoyle analogy, which I really like. I love
to be honest, I've used that before. That wasn't thought of the top of my head. I had that
in great. Yeah. Oh, that's very comforting. Cool. Awesome. Well, this has been very fun, Pete. I miss you, man. I hope you're having a great time.
Man, I miss you so much. I can't wait to see you in about a week. And we'll hang out and go for a drink and catch up properly.
Perfect, man. We'll enjoy the rest of, I guess, your evening now.
You too, man. Take care.
All right.
Goodbye, everybody who's listening.
Yeah, bye, everybody.